This week on Making Contact.
U.S. oil companies have been meeting with the U.S. administration to figure out how they're going to divide the so-called spoils of the war.
While the reasons a country goes to war are complex, there's no doubt that oil, a pillar of the United States' foreign policy since the Carter administration, is a vital interest in the Persian Gulf. Iraq, currently known to have 11% of the world's oil, is estimated to have huge untapped oil fields, which could mean big profits for oil companies. And with an increased military budget, now at $400 billion, the weapons industry is gearing up and cashing in. On this edition of Making Contact, we take a look at the economic interests behind the war against Iraq. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. It's brisk business for weapons suppliers these days. Michelle Shiraka, Senior Research Associate at the Arms Trade Resource Center, says in preparation for a war in Iraq and to replace the weapons used in Afghanistan, many weapons suppliers have increased production. Boeing added a second shift of workers to boost production of the most widely used so-called smart bomb in the attack on Afghanistan. Raytheon added a third shift of workers and announced it accelerated the production of its laser-guided bomb by 5 months. And Alliant Tech Systems, the largest supplier of ammunition to the U.S. military, was awarded a $92 million contract to make small-caliber ammunition for the Army. Shiraka says these weapons are being funded by what she calls a wartime bonanza of new military contracts.
Right now, we're looking at a defense budget that is reached just about $400 billion. And this is coming from an administration that had talked during the campaign about increasing defense spending only about $50 billion. So in the past, Bush's 22 months in office, we've seen more than $150 billion in new military spending. Now, some of this is going for the new Department of Homeland Defense, which originally in 2001-2002 had a budget of about $18 billion. Now that budget has almost doubled to $38 billion. Specifically, the Pentagon's budget has increased from about $340 billion to about $390 billion. We've also seen a number of what has been called emergency funding requests since 9/11, and of that, of those funds, about $20 billion has gone to the Pentagon.
And behind these numbers is a human toll. Rania Masri, director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center of the Institute for Southern Studies.
Well, for those of us who remember the 1991 war against Iraq, we may remember the February attack against the shelter, the Ahmadiyya shelter in Baghdad. Basically, we had 400 women and children who were killed by two so-called smart missiles, or otherwise known as bunker busters, that penetrated. And these people basically burned to death, and their remains were imprinted into the walls. Well, the U.S. administration has said that that bunker buster is not strong enough. So they have now developed a bunker buster that is twice the weight of that one and three times the penetrating power. One that is produced by Lockheed Martin, which when tested in New Mexico ended up more than 100 feet below the New Mexico desert floor. And what makes this all the more horrific is that we know when looking into the Lockheed Martin patent that this weapon will contain depleted uranium. So now we're talking about having depleted uranium not only on the surface of the ground, which was what happened in 1991. 300 tons of DU were basically contaminating the Iraq's environmental surface. But now we're talking about DU even, you know, being placed below the ground, 100 feet below the ground.
Shiraka says Bush's ties are stronger to weapons contractors than any other administration. 32 key appointees were executives, consultants, or major shareholders of top weapons contractors prior to joining the Bush administration.
You have the Secretary of the Air Force, James Roche, who's a former Northrop Grumman vice president. You have Secretary of the Navy, Gordon England, who's a former General Dynamics vice president. You have former Lockheed Martin Chief Operating Officer Peter Teets, who is now the Undersecretary of the Air Force and Director of the National Reconnaissance Office. There's a number, the list goes on. Many have joked that when Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was appointing all of these corporate executives, that now we could start calling it Department of Defense Incorporated.
While private corporations like Enron have bought access and influence in the government through campaign contributions and lobbying, Sharaka says the weapons manufacturers' ties are far greater, yet are given little scrutiny.
In a report on the corporate ties in the Bush administration from the Public Eye, it's the Center for Public Integrity in D.C., they showed that 14 executives, executive branch officials in the Bush administration owned Enron stocks, while 25 Bush officials held stock in defense corporations. When looking at specifically the political action contributions and the soft money donations, Enron contributed $2.4 million in individual PAC and soft money contributions to federal candidates, while Lockheed Martin contributed $2.7 million in individual PAC and soft money contributions over the same time period. And that's just Lockheed Martin. We could, again, look at Boeing and Raytheon and TRW. And those donations kind of pale in comparison to the amount of money these corporations spend on lobbying each year. Lockheed Martin spends about $4.2 million lobbying. Boeing spends about $8.2 million, compared to Enron, who spent, I think, $1.9 million. And these numbers are from the Center for Responsive Politics in D.C.
Ties to the government aren't restricted to the weapons industry. Jim Vollette, Research Director for the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, says as much as they try to hide it, Bush and Cheney are the most oily administration in this country's history. Bush comes from Texas Oil, and Vice President Dick Cheney was formerly CEO of Halliburton, a company that installs oil pipelines.
Dick Cheney is CEO of Halliburton. Lobbied Congress to get rid of sanctions against Iran and Libya, the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act. And in Libya, Halliburton has been the major contractor through its subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root on a massive water project in Libya, the largest infrastructure project in North Africa over the last 20 years. So Halliburton and Dick Cheney got rich off of expanding their business into very repressive countries. In the Caspian, Dick Cheney was named honorary chairman of the U.S. Kazakhstan Chamber of Commerce. Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, he tried to get rid of sanctions, which have actually happened on that country. And in Turkmenistan, Halliburton has had a big contract for a refinery there and some pipeline projects. And Dick Cheney has said, when he was the head of Halliburton, he said, someone asked him about the dangers of doing business with these sort of regimes. He says, I don't think about it very much. I don't think about political volatility very much. You've got to go where the oil is.
Vollette says this statement resonates with the Bush administration's stance. Current Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was originally selected in the 80s by the Reagan administration to meet with Saddam Hussein. Masri points out at that same time, Amnesty International released a report criticizing human rights abuses in Iraq.
And he met with Saddam Hussein, and among the things that happened was he assured Saddam Hussein that there would be no repercussions because of his civil rights abuses in Iraq. Incidentally, Senator Bob Dole also met with Saddam Hussein after the Halabja massacre and assured him that there would be no repercussions then. Rumsfeld specifically met with Saddam Hussein after the gassing of Iranians. So we know quite clearly that there was very good dealings with the regime at that time. We also know when we look at statements made by the CIA and statements made by the Ba'athist Party themselves, that the Saddam Hussein regime itself got into power courtesy of the CIA. I mean, they would not have gotten into power had it not been for the support of the CIA and for the whole economic, diplomatic, and military support of the U.S. administration since. And what we have seen as the shift in U.S. policy towards Iraq was not due to the accumulation of weapons of mass destruction, not due to the human rights violations and civil rights violations. It was due to the end of the Iraq-Iran war. The moment that war ended was when, here in the United States, Saddam Hussein became the bad man. That was when Saddam Hussein became compared to Hitler, 2 years before the invasion of Kuwait. And it was also during that time that I believe that, you know, the U.S. government was starting to prepare itself for an attack against Iraq.
We might have very good purposes there. We might be truly trying to promote democracy and freedom for the Iraqi people.
John Granoff, president of the Global Security Institute.
You know, we might be planning to really strengthen and build that country from the damage that's been done over the war they had with Iran and then the bombing they've suffered from us and so forth. I don't really know what the plan is, but I do know that the oil industry seems to have a disproportionate influence on the Bush administration. So many people in the Bush team come from the oil industry. Condoleezza Rice was on the board of Chevron. Cheney was an oil man. Bush himself was an oil man. And I'm concerned that they may be exercising an undue influence on our policy in that region.
He says individuals within the administration, like Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, are pushing for the use of force in a regime change in Iraq. Wolfowitz advocated this use of force in a December 2002 speech titled Building a Bridge to a More Peaceful Future.
We are trying to achieve the disarmament of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, to eliminate this serious danger to the United States and the world, if possible, by peaceful means. But by one means or another, we will eliminate that threat. As President Bush made clear in Prague, Iraq must disarm, voluntarily or by force. That goal will be achieved. But 11 years of bitter experience makes it clear that Saddam Hussein will give up those weapons only, I repeat, only if he believes that doing so is the only way for him and his regime to survive. The debate is not between those who desire peace and those who love war. Indeed, I know of no one except perhaps the terrorists who loves war. The issue we face today as a nation is how best to increase the chances of a peaceful outcome. And let's acknowledge there is a seeming paradox here that for some people may be difficult to understand. The simple truth is that our only hope of achieving that peaceful outcome is if we confront the Iraqi regime with a credible threat of force behind our diplomacy. To be effective, the two must be part of a single policy. They are not two separate policies.
Well, I have to say, I would rather characterize his speech as bombing the bridge to a peaceful future.
Zayed Abu Rish, an organizer for Global Exchange, was one of the protesters gathering outside the San Francisco hotel where Wolfowitz was speaking.
I think what he's talking about in there, he uses the guise of a peaceful future, but it's really a strategic future which lays out the plan for U.S. global dominance over resources around the world at the cost of the lives of the human beings and the populations of those countries that have those resources.
Vallet says these are all pieces of the same puzzle.
You have a president who refused, and a vice president who refused to believe in CAFE standards and fuel economy standards for the U.S. transportation fleet, who supports the views of ExxonMobil that there's somehow still some question that there's a relationship between fossil fuel consumption and greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. And you have the unprecedented deployment of U.S. troops in the Middle East. You have this great game in the Caspian and in Iraq. You have new military bases being set up in West Africa, and you have the training of troops in Colombia, all for the purpose of continuing this IV fluid going into the vein of the U.S. economy. And who is that benefiting? It's not benefiting U.S. consumers other than keeping the price of oil down a little bit, but it's really for the benefit of big oil, and it's for the benefit of the oil contractors like Halliburton.
While it's clear there are energy interests in the Middle East, Global Security Institute's Granoff says the impact of U.S. involvement in the region has never been sufficiently addressed by the administration.
What's not being covered by the press is asking questions about how do we intend to leave Iraq? Do we plan to stay there? Where would we stay? Have contracts been made with construction companies to build air bases in Iraq for U.S. planes, large enough to take in large numbers of planes? Do we have these plans? And what kind of a government would we support there? What if there's a government in Iraq that gets elected by the Iraqi people and wants to nationalize their oil industry and not give prices that we like in the oil market? What would we do then? Is it the plan of the United States to take over the oil fields and then influence OPEC oil pricing? Those are questions that are not being asked. And I think it's the larger context that we need to understand.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for cassette or CD copy of this program. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. The deployment of the military to secure diverse sources of oil has been part of the U.S. national security policy since the 1970s energy crisis. Stephen Kretzmann, oil policy analyst with the Institute for Policy Studies, says this approach has only been getting stronger.
And it's explicitly spelled out in the Bush-Cheney energy plan in a way that perhaps jumps out at you and in a way that it hadn't before, but it is truly, in many ways, unfortunately, nothing new. But it's there, and if you equate, if you then say, okay, well, if it's in our national security interest to have free and unfettered access here, and if you say, okay, we're going to use the military to guarantee that, then yes, but it doesn't actually say anything about the military per se.
Kretzmann says it would be a global economic disaster if the Saudi regime fell or if terrorists attacked key elements of the Saudi reserves.
Right now, for the global economy, Saudi Arabia is the indispensable man. There's virtually no scenario out there that if someone, for whatever reason, were to, you know, literally or figuratively turn off the oil tap from Saudi Arabia, there's no way for, I mean, the Western economy would essentially, if not come to a halt, certainly grind and screech a lot, because there's just, they supply so much of the daily oil of the global economy, that if you take Saudi Arabia out of the picture, there's not enough excess capacity left from the other countries that produce oil to make up for it. Now, Iraq has the second largest amount of excess capacity in the world. So it's possible, it's possible to conceive of at least being able to ride out for a little bit longer the possibility of a disruption in Saudi supplies if you have access to Iraqi supplies. And Iraq is pretty much the only other country in the world that could do that. And so I think that's a clear motivating factor for getting access to those reserves. And it may, because since September 11th, there's obvious nervousness on the part of the Bush administration and planners everywhere about continued dependence on the Saudis.
And the stakes are high. The western half of Iraq is poorly explored, and geologists believe there may be huge untapped reserves. This could mean a huge boon for oil companies.
Well, I know that the oil companies have been meeting, and specifically U.S. oil companies, have been meeting with the U.S. administration to figure out how they're going to divide the so-called spoils of the war. I know that there have been discussions with the Iraqi National Congress, this so-called opposition umbrella, where we have had INC representatives such as their leader, Ahmed Chalabi, among others, state quite clearly, quote, American oil companies will have the first shot at Iraqi oil. So those discussions I know are already taking place. Now, in what detail, I'm not sure.
ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco, according to the independent newspaper in London, refused to say if they're holding talks with the Iraqi opposition. Both said, however, that if the sanctions were lifted, the company would be interested in dealing with Iraq. Kretzmann says oil companies will almost certainly benefit from a regime change.
Well, it's not surprising, man. I think that oil services companies like Halliburton, like Schlumberger, obviously, you know, once a new regime gets in there, will be well positioned to go in and repair Iraq's oil facilities. And it'll take a lot longer to figure out how ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco and others are going to be able to come in force to take over large fields. But it's not surprising, and it's absolutely not surprising that they would be the quickest winners from any kind of a regime change, because the first thing that's going to happen is repair of those Iraqi oil fields, because the new government is going to want to make money, and that's going to be the way they perceive they can do it.
Currently, France and Russia have stakes in Iraq. Kretzmann says if they don't support war, they could lose claims and billions of dollars in potential profit. Masri says it's international consumption of oil, not just oil within the U.S., that's driving the war effort.
So when we look at the fact that Iraq is either the first or the second largest holder of oil reserves in the world, depending upon which survey we trust, and then we take into consideration that it is the Europeans, primarily the Germans, and second the Japanese, that depend upon Arab oil, and in particular Iraqi oil, then we can seek to understand that with American control over Iraqi oil, we then have greater control over these other countries. Furthermore, another plan of the U.S. administration is to dismantle OPEC, to dismantle the oil cartel, and therefore to greatly weaken any political power by the Arab countries and by other oil-producing countries, which includes Venezuela, by the way, because Venezuela is a member of OPEC.
Meanwhile, the U.S. military is being deployed around the world to an unprecedented extent to secure oil. Vallette of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network says many of these efforts are in poor countries with repressive regimes.
In West Africa, for example, the administration is considering setting up the first ever U.S. military base in that region, in the Gulf of Guinea, in order to have a major U.S. military presence around the oil fields, specifically because there's all these big vats of oil now sitting off of the coasts of Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea and Sao Tome and Principe. In Colombia, the U.S. military is training the Colombian military on how to secure the oil pipeline that's controlled by Occidental Petroleum. And in the Caspian, there's a massive game going on in order to secure that region's oil for the Western marketplace.
The Institute for Policy Studies, Kretzmann, says countries that rely on oil as their primary export are more likely to be engaged in some kind of civil war than those with more balanced economies.
The sad fact of the matter is, although there's this perception out there that oil leads to riches and that, you know, the discovery of oil equals black gold, time and again around the world, what we see is that oil breeds more poverty and oil breeds repression and authoritarian regimes. There's a stunningly high correlation in between bad repressive forms of government and the amount of oil that a country exports.
He says governments that are dependent on oil are likely to spend much of their wealth on arms to defend themselves and their source of power.
Oil companies have a huge problem now in countries like Nigeria or Colombia, where the local population is not particularly fond of what they're doing, and where the centralized government does not particularly represent the local population. And I think that what's happening in both those countries will pale in comparison to what could potentially happen in Iraq if a U.S.-installed regime goes in and gives away contracts to U.S. oil companies, or almost any other oil companies for that matter, against the wishes of the people.
Masri of the Institute for Southern Studies says a civil war could break out in Iraq as a result of a war.
The U.S. government is thinking about imposing a regime on the Iraqi people. And the Iraqi National Congress is definitely not loved in Iraq by both those people who oppose Saddam Hussein and definitely by those who love Saddam Hussein, simply because the INC is an organization that is working with the CIA and is benefiting from the CIA money. So how could we expect the Iraqis, who for 12 years have been suffering directly under U.S. policy, to possibly embrace an appendage of U.S. policy under the vestige of the INC? That won't happen. And we have to remember that there are numerous Iraqi opposition groups who are not members of the INC.
The price tag for war, Masri says, will be at least $100 billion, not to mention the tremendous loss of life.
The lowest estimate that we've received is 28,000 Iraqi civilians, and the number could be as large as a few hundred thousand. This is not taking into impact the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that may die as indirect causes of the war, basically from starvation, basically from lack of clean water, from poor sanitation in the refugee camps that are being inadequately built in Turkey, from other indirect aspects of the war.
Vallette says this pursuit of oil is placing the United States in a situation of increasing insecurity, the antithesis of what's being promoted as a war on terrorism.
The global economy and the U.S. economy's dependence on big oil is not right for the times anymore. It may have helped to make the U.S. a global empire through the 20th century, but in the 21st century, in order for the United States to survive and for the world to have real security, we need to no longer be dependent on oil. And we need to, because the technologies are there, we can meet our basic human needs for heat and movement and transportation without depending upon oil.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Sarah Olson, Liz Tascio, and Ellen Horn for production help. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, or get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for a cassette or CD copy of the program. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Peggy Law is founding director, managing producer Philip Babbage, women's desk director Lisa Rudman, office manager Rosalyn Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national producer David Barsamian, and I'm your host and associate producer Amy Pomerlo. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time,